Yes. Okay, shall we get started? I'll start this week with a number of announcements. First, a good announcement. Next week there will be no lectures. Yeah, everybody who's cheering now will get 1 point less on their final. No, just kidding. Now, next week is week 40, which is in Oppland always Höstferie, and actually I will be in Trondheim at NTNU that exact day. So that was the first one. The second one is that I get a lot of questions about assignment 2, so apparently I wasn't clear enough. What you have to do in the end, beside the report, is to deliver a MATLAB function. Should look something like this. So function, good or bad, or whatever name you give it, is password checker and then a password. So the input is a password, and the output will be a string good or the string bad, one of those. Somewhere in this program you have to include a word list. A list, a dictionary, I call that. And that dictionary is you got actually two dictionaries. You got short list and you get long list. Yeah, but then not realizing that actually I then would not know which would be in the final program, I wrote in Blackboard, call it word list. You can put that in your program already, or you can run your program with short list and long list, or you can just copy your short list or long list to word list or whatever. That's up to you. But the final program should call the function, should call the list word list. Then suppose that this is a part of your dictionary, or the dictionary that I will be using. I will be using my own. Yeah, so there is a number of words in there. This is just the beginning, all in alphabetical order. And so if I would test your program with, for example, abnormal, the output should be bad. Why should it be bad? Because it's only 8 characters, should be at least 9, remember. It's only lowercase letters, and should be a mixture. And abnormal is actually in this list. Yeah. So somebody might try to be smart, might do something like abnormal 123. Okay, that should again, your program should classify that as bad, because if I remove the letters at the end of this word, then I am left with a dictionary word. Yeah, similar for if I use capitals or if I a combination of those, something else at the end. If I change the O by a zero and the A by the at symbol, again it should qualify that as bad. Yeah, all of these passwords should be qualified as bad. If I would turn it around, so abnormal, lamronba, then again it should say something like bad. If I would say airport 123, actually this, your password checker should say good. Can't do anything else. Because, well, it is at least 9 characters. It has a combination of letters and numbers. If I remove the numbers at the end, I'm left with a word which is not in the dictionary. Yeah, and because it's not in the dictionary, I can't say based on the fact that, hey, this is an English word, because I don't know if it's an English word, that it should be removed. There was a question.
Yeah, but what if we have like more guidelines? You said we have a lot of freedom in this task.
Yeah, okay, one second. There is a lot of freedom in this task. So how would your program react to something like air drones? Air drone is here. So how would it react to this? Yeah, if I put an S to the end. Or what if I airlift, I make it airlifting. How does it react to that? How does it react to something like this? So there is your freedom, because these I also mentioned in the assignment. But how does it react to this?
Yeah, but like my code would reject airport 123.
Why?
Because in my opinion, airport 123 is a bad password.
So no. No, not your opinion. It's your program. I'm not grading your opinion. I'm grading your program. So why does your program...
My program is checking, for example, you have to have 3 out of 4 symbols.
Okay. Then capital airport. How about that?
Then it would still reject it because I also have a sequence checker and you have like...
Okay, great. Then I'll change the O into a 0 also. Okay. Let me be straight. The fact is that I can't reject it. You have a number of checks, which is great. That's good. But you can't reject it because you say this is in the dictionary.
Yeah,
that is my point here. So even though everybody of us can see that this is a bad password because airport is a normal English word, that English word is not in this list. And so based on that, I can't reject it. I can reject it on many other grounds. Like you say, I want at least 3 out of 4 and not just 2. I don't want the capital in the beginning and the numbers at the end, and then, yeah. So that's all checks that you have additionally. That's great. Yeah. Write that in your report also. So on the one hand, we have a dictionary that I will check words against. On the other hand, I will have a database, my personal database of such kind of words that I will use to run through your program and see how it responds to that. So, and if at some point here it would say good, because it doesn't recognize that a word is reversed, okay, that's not a good thing. Yeah, and if you also check for something like this, yeah, that's a good thing. Yeah, if you classify this as bad, because this is bad, right? Yeah, so the more you do, the higher your grade will be. The more bad passwords in my database you will actually discover as bad passwords. And I can be very creative. Was that a bit more clear on the task? Okay, if not, just call out on us on call out to us on Skype or in the Slack room. In the Slack room I also found this. This was in the general room. This was message says yesterday, I believe, and so I wanted to say this is a message from Nurshis, which is Norwegian Center for Information Sikring, which is co-located with us in the A building. They have some DLT job for a company called Sletme that they are running. DLT jobs means that it's a part-time job, means not 37 and a half hours, but how many hours? I have no idea. How it's a job, how well it is paid, I have no idea. Yeah? But it is a way to get experience. Man må beherske norsk veldig bra, både skriftlig og muntlig. So that might exclude all the foreigners, but for the Norwegians, mainly, who are interested in this extra job, could be very interesting. As said, they are located with us in the A building, so it's not a long distance that you have to travel. And if you want more information, contact Hans Marius from Norsis, or maybe Tonje. Yeah. You know about this also, or? Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah, so there are a number of people that could help you out, yeah?
Do we need to speak Norwegian?
Yeah. So if you couldn't read that sentence, then apparently you disqualify. Why Sletme.no is a service for people in Norway, and you can't expect somebody to call. If a kid is calling, you can't expect them to speak English. So you have to be able to answer them in Norwegian. Okay. More information you can find at with other people from Gnosis. Let's go to what I believe is the most interesting presentation that I will give this semester. Biometrics. Here is a definition of biometrics, one that I found a couple of years ago. In biometrics, we use automated methods to recognize or verify the identity of a living person based on biological or behavioral characteristics. So a lot of words in there, a lot of bold words. Automated means that it's not me doing the task, it's a machine. I can do face recognition. I recognize the people in this room. But it's a computer that needs to be able to do this task. Recognize and verify are just other words for identification and authentication, and we talked about that last week, and I told you that this week actually I will redefine them slightly. Living person, there are two things there. Living, so we're not, there's not a dead body lying here and I'm taking his fingerprints, no, that's forensics. Person means a single individual. I'm trying to authenticate one single person and not a group of persons, although I will deviate from that at some point. But then we don't call it biometrics anymore. And the biological and behavioral, I mentioned that last week also. Biological is physical characteristics like a fingerprint, a face, iris, shape of an ear or whatever. Behavioral is things that we learn to do. So that's one definition that I've been using for years. Here is another, which is an ISO standard definition. Automated recognition of individuals based on their behavioral and biological characteristics. So a number of parts are the same there. But they define behavioral and biological slightly different, probably better than what I do. Behavioral has to do with the function of the body, the way that I talk, the way that I walk, the way that I write a signature. And biological or anatomical has to do with the structure of the body. So slightly different and better definition. If you want to find these definitions, just go to the website of Christoph Busch. He has a long list available there. Okay, very briefly something on the history, because biometrics is not something new in the sense that we are using in our automated systems. Yeah, that's new. But looking at fingerprints for recognizing people, that's not something new. Dates actually back to ancient Egypt already. Yeah, recognizing somebody from, that was not fingerprints, but the workers on the pyramids were recognized. They got some salary, they got some food or whatever. Yeah. Obviously, you don't want somebody who just came gave food to get in line again and get food again. Or get payment again. So the administrator wrote down a number of characteristics. Okay, I've given food to this and this and this person with who is so high and he's tall. He has blue eyes. Yes. So he wrote something down, and then he could check the next time that somebody came that person didn't get paid already. Then in the 1870s, 1880s, people started measuring body parts. What is the circumference of my skull? How tall am I? How far is the distance from the tip of my middle finger until my wrist? Something like that. These kind of measurements. Bodily measurements. Fingerprint and palm prints. Palm print is actually a large... fingerprint is just a small part. Palm print is a larger area. Were used long time ago, but... only recently people started to study that more clearly. This is also in the 1800s. I will not say that much about it because this afternoon Emil will give a presentation on that. First, more structural work was done by Fords, Herschel, and Gultow in the 1880s. Then if we go to look at automated system, you see that it comes up with the rise of the computer, of course. So in the 1960s, speaker and fingerprint recognition started. A decade later, we went over to geometry of the hand, so the shape of the hand, not the palm print, just the shape. Retina, the back of the eye, signature and face verification came the decade after that, and then in the 1990s, the work by John Dorkman, on iris recognition, very famous work. And then from, let's say, this century, we started working on newer let's say, more exotic kind of recognizing of people. I said I would define authentication and identification because they're slightly different from the definition that we used last week. In authentication, I'm verifying a claimed identity. So I claim an identity. I'm Patrick, and here is proof that I'm Patrick. Identification is establishing an identity. So as an analogy, when I want to get access to my computer, I type my username, which is my claim of my identity. And then I prove that that is my identity by giving my password. And I'm the only one who knows my password, hopefully. So that must be me. I claim an identity, and then it's verified that this is the correct password. Identification, establishing an identity. So it's your mother calling or your friend calling or whatever, and you answer the phone and you just hear on the other side, hey, it's me. Hey, it's me is not really claiming an identity, but you recognize the voice. Say, oh yeah, that's John, or that's my mom, or that's my dad, or whatever. Yeah? So no identity was claimed, but from all the people that you know, you just single out that one person. So the here, we answer, is this person the person he or she claims to be? And we do a one-to-one verification. I have a database with all people in there, but I don't look at all these people. I just look at this particular person, yeah, from which the identity is claimed, and I check against that those credentials. In identification, we are asking ourselves, who is this person? And we are verifying this information from that one person against everybody in the database. So one against many verification. So that's one distinction that we can make in biometrics, identification versus authentication. We can also look at positive and negative recognition. So that's a slightly different way of looking at it. Positive recognition is to prevent multiple people from using the same identity. So my fingerprint is different from your fingerprint, so you can't claim to be me. Multiple people can't claim my identity. Only I can do that. Negative recognition is to prevent one person from using multiple identities. Hey, I found your fingerprint here. That's you. No, I can't claim to be somebody else. No, that's my fingerprint. You can check that. And so that must be me. I can't say that was somebody else. Positive recognition, that's the same. Positive recognition is easy with biometrics, but you can alternatively use passwords and tokens, what we discussed last week. Negative recognition, that's forensics. Forensic work. Yeah, that's on a crime scene. There is my fingerprint. There is my DNA. I can't claim that it wasn't me. Yeah. We can't do that with passwords or tokens. So biometrics is the only way to solve this. Or biometric techniques. Let's look at a number of examples. So we have biological and behavioral biometrics. These are a few that we mentioned already. Voice. If you say it's something you learn to do, well, is voice a biological or a behavioral biometric? That is always a bit difficult. Was always a bit difficult because up to some level we learned it. Up to some level it is how your throat is formed internally. Yeah. So it was a middle. But if we look at the ISO definition, a function of the body, well, talking is a function of the body. So then it's clear that it should be there. Some more here. Hand, the shape of the hand or palm print and retina, the back of the eye. And gait, the way that we walk, and keystroke dynamics, the way that we type on a keyboard are here mentioned too. The way that we use a mouse also. Can anybody come up with other biometrics? Other examples. Let's start at biological biometrics. What things can we look at? Any suggestions? Yeah, sorry.
I think you mentioned the ear last week.
Oh, the hair.
My ear.
Oh, ear. Yeah, shape of the ear. Yeah, that should be on my list. Is it on my list? It should be. Yeah, it's on my list. I'll show it in a minute. Yeah, there was, yeah.
Toe?
Eh?
Toe.
Yeah. Fingerprint and toe print is the same. So these lines, these ridges and valleys on a fingerprint, that you have them on your toe and on your feet, the full foot in principle, the shape of the foot, I could say. Thermogram is actually looking at the heat that we are sending out. Yeah, we can use it for various things, but what it is used for, or what it has been used for in research at least, is for face recognition. What is the problem with face recognition? What is one of the problems with face recognition? Identical twins. Yeah, but even if the face of identical twins is the same, the way internally that the veins are wired, there is a slight deviation in that. Same as their fingerprint is different. But if I look at the face, I don't see any differences. Right? But because internally the veins are wired differently, so some are closer to the skin and some are further away from the skin, etc. So then if I look at how much heat somebody is sending out, that will be different. Yeah?
Maybe some birthmarks or some injuries?
It can help, but I will tell you later on why that is not a... Well, we don't consider that as biometric. Ear, what was said here, was said up there. Vein patterns. I can actually look inside a finger or inside a palm and look at the veins, how they have grown, and I can use that. Used, for example, in bank terminals in Japan and in Brazil. Odor, the way that we smell. Dental. Yeah, often used in forensics. Yeah, if you find a dead body, you look at his teeth and you look at the dental records and you can find out who this person was. But you can use it in biometrics too. Or DNA. Although DNA might be kind of slow to do the analysis. Footprint, which was said here also. Then I will just go over this list. In behavioral, email behavioral, how we write emails. Yeah, we have some people who write lengthy emails. Yeah, so if you expect a yes-no answer, you get a novel to write. But that's something typical of a particular person that I know. And okay, when I see an email from him, if I just see the heading, I know it's a long email. Otherwise, if I would see the long email, I would know it's from him. Question. Yeah, very interesting that you mentioned that. I will come back to that this afternoon. Very interesting. Game strategies. That is something, behavioral biometrics, that is also very, very personal. The way that we interact with a graphical user interface. Simply said, if I have in front of me a PDF, yeah, when I'm reading it, I could scroll line by line. I could scroll with the mouse or with the keys. I could scroll page by page. If I want to print it, yeah, how do I print a PDF document? Well, I would do Ctrl P and then go from there. Some people will take the mouse, go to the mouse, I can click. Some people might do Alt F for opening the file menu and then print. So different options possible. Lip movement, the way that we move our lips. Touchscreen interaction is more or less the same as keystroke and mouse dynamics, except now we have a touchscreen instead of a keyboard and a mouse. And gestures, so the way that we move our hands. Car driving. Yeah, car driving is also interesting. The way that we drive on a car. If some people will speed up very fast and then brake very hard again when they have to stop. Some people will do that more gently, more smoothly. If you have to take a corner, is it like, or is it more smoothly? And so driving behavior also differs per person. I will go into a number of those just so that you have a better idea of what this all is. So blinking, there has been done research on blinking, and the idea was think of some secret pattern. Maybe based on a song, and so you know how to blink. You can easily remember it. You can measure, let's say, blinks versus non-blinks, so you get a binary pattern. You can measure maybe even time between blinks and non-blinks, the time that eyes are closed. Very interesting. I'm not sure about the results exactly, but I know that they published a very disturbing picture. But what they did simply is they had a camera on somebody and somebody was blinking, and then they take snapshot of it, or at regular times they take a snapshot, and so the eye is closed or the eye is open, and so you got the pattern like 10011, etc. Yeah, or you can measure exactly the time that it is happening. Car driving behavior, as I said, so we differ in the way that we drive. Could be very interesting for major car companies. It doesn't do a lot for Skoda or a minor car company, but the expensive cars, Mercedes-Benz, Ferrari, they could have some sensors built in that measure how somebody drives, and if that deviates from what the real owner would do, the car could stop. Actually, I am in contact with Mercedes-Benz. They are interested in this topic, and if there is a student who thinks this could be very interesting for my master thesis and wants to travel to California, I believe, for 6 months to do this work, then please contact me. DNA, we talked about that. DNA is very personal. DNA of every person is different. I said almost unique per person. In principle, it doesn't matter where I take the DNA, if I take it from my skin or my hair or whatever. Yeah, it's the same DNA. So why would it be possible that I have two types of DNA string in my body? If you have a transplant, you get the DNA of somebody else implanted. But obviously, these are the exceptional cases. Ear, shape of the ear. So this is the early work by, forgot his name, Ian Nali or something like that. So he measured from the tip of your this earlobe, he measures a number of distances, and that set of numbers is fairly unique. The shape of the ear is also used in forensics. Why? Because as a criminal, I have this house that I want to rob, and obviously I don't just storm in because people might be inside. So what I'll do is I'll listen at the window if I hear some noises, and then if I don't hear anything, then I can just go in. But that leaves on the window an ear print. And so this has been used in court cases. Shape of the ear. Face recognition. Face recognition is what we humans do a lot. But to tell a machine how to do it is much more difficult, of course. There are different techniques possible. One of them is either in 2D or 3D. 3D face recognition is also possible. Find a number of landmarks. So where is the tip of the nose? Where is the outer parts of the lip? Where are the eyes located? Where is the bridge of the nose? And if I locate all these points, then I can compare them to a known set of points for a particular person. And I can do that in 2D or 3D or whatever you want. Obviously, if you can get a nice 3D picture of my face, that's great. But if I'm looking down or whatever, or if the camera is further away, then I might miss out points, or there might be at a smaller distance between them and everything. So you need to do some scaling. Another method is what is called eigenfaces, where I train a system with a lot of images. Yeah, and normally if we talk about a point in space, we talk about an X, Y, and Z coordinate. Yeah. So a picture, here you see a picture of a face, is in principle an X and Y coordinate, a lot of X, Y coordinates, and on every pixel has a value, so X, Y, Z coordinate too, but many of those, right? What they do in eigenfaces is actually come up with a kind of a new coordinate system based on learning with the number of faces, and then an image of a face is not built up of a number of pixels, but an image of a face is a linear combination of a number of these images. Yeah, and whatever linear combination of these images it is, that defines a particular person. Fingerprint. Will not say a lot about it because Emil is taking this afternoon. In a fingerprint, we have black and white lines. Yeah, those are called valleys and ridges. So ridges are the dark ones, the ones that are in contact with the scanner. The valleys of my fingerprint are a bit deeper in the skin, and so they don't show up. So those are white. And then in biometrics, what I'm looking for is a number of what is called minutiae points. And a minutiae point is when I look at a particular ridge and I see if this ridge is stopping somewhere, a ridge ending, or maybe if this ridge is splitting into two ridges, which is called a ridge bifurcation. And so those locations are called minutiae, and then those are used. And those are mapped between two images. Gait recognition, so the way that we walk, is also very typical from Shakespeare already, so a long time ago. Great eunuch comes, I know her by her gait. That was actually a play where the idea was, okay, I hear somebody walking. I'm listening to the sound of somebody walking, and I recognize that. You have it if you live together with other people. If somebody, if one of my kids storms down the stairs, I know exactly which of the two it is. Right? So that's relatively easy to do. Gait recognition can either be done video-based, floor sensor-based, or wearable sensor-based. So video-based is I have a camera, and I'm having a videotape of somebody walking by, and then I analyze those images. Floor sensor-based is that I have a special area in the floor where there are some sensors that can measure pressure, and so I can see where the pressure is, and so I can see something about how far apart the steps are and how fast somebody's walking and how much pressure there is, and use that. Wearable sensor is where I have some kind of sensor that measures acceleration. I have it in my pocket. Could be a mobile phone also. I have it in my pocket, and that information is measured, and based on that signal, I do recognition. And actually, this sound-based gait recognition, I will be in Madrid at a conference 4 weeks from now, and there I will discuss this issue because a student in the fall in the spring has taken that up as a topic in the biometrics course, and we wrote a paper based on that. And he will now do his master thesis on this topic. So we can all, I could add audio based to this. Hand geometry, I mentioned that already, so we have the hand in a particular place. There's a number of pins that guide where my hand should be, and then I measure width of a finger and width of the hand, and et cetera, et cetera. Iris recognition, initiated by Dogman, long time ago already, and then he had a patent on that, both in America and in Europe, and so nobody was using it until that patent expired, and then the work on iris recognition boomed. In iris recognition, there are a number of circles around the pupil, and there is a fixed number of circles. So if your pupil is highly dilated, yet all of those will be more narrow. And then I measure some particulars of each of these rings, and then that's encoded in binary up there. Works for humans. We are actually investigating if it also works for salmon. The problem with the human is that in the first 2 years of a baby, the iris changes. So far, we have noticed that the iris of a salmon also changes over time. So we have about 3,000 salmon in the research that we're doing. We have about 3,000 salmon that are followed from babies to real salmon that will be farmed. Well, those will not be farmed anymore anyway. But we're following them and checking if the iris is getting stable at some point in time. So far, unfortunately, no luck. But iris recognition has been done on cows in India. So it's not just for humans. Keystroke dynamics, again, I will not say that much about it. I'll talk about it in the afternoon also. We can measure when a key is pressed down, when a key is released. And based on these measurements, 99% of all the research is based on that kind of measurement. Based on these measurements, we can identify or authenticate a person. We could add other things. We could add pressure, which finger we use if we have a camera that could capture that, and we can look at sound. We haven't done this, at least not in biometrics, but it could be interesting if I type my PIN code on such a number pad. Then you can see again with thermograms, you can see which of these key is hottest. So this particular pin code contained 1, 4, 5, and 8, probably in the opposite order. 8 and 5 are still very warm, so probably those are the last two symbols, and 1 and 4 are probably the first two symbols because they're cooling down a bit already. Lip movement, that's something I could combine with face recognition. Yeah, so I'm not just taking a picture of a face and that's it. No, I'm capturing a video of a face and doing face recognition, and besides that, I'm looking at the movement of lips when somebody is saying their secret sentence. And it doesn't need to be that secret, because if you're saying it, everybody can hear it. But to mimic the lip movement of a person, obviously, is difficult. Mouse movement, In mouse dynamics, we see how a mouse is used. So what do I do with the mouse? Well, I can move it, I can click on it, I can move and click, I can click and do a drag and drop, and we measure all these kinds of things. Difficult to find interesting pictures with that, so I had this one. But the first time that I started to work on mouse dynamics, I was looking for mouse and biometrics, and actually I found something on mice recognition. So recognizing mice in a biometric way. And so what they did is they looked at the ear of a mouse, which is very translucent. And so they captured where the veins were. And so you get a pattern like this that was analyzed then. Odor. The smell of a person is very typical, his own. Sometimes we notice that with other humans, hopefully not too often. But dogs. Dogs can follow a trail of a person. If a person is missing, yeah, the dog sniffs some clothing of that person and can follow that trail. And that, so that shows that it is unique. Obviously, if I want to get access to my computer via odor, I can't see that. Yeah, you get something like this, but that's disturbing. And I don't want this lady to just stand next to me every time that I want to open my computer. Palm print, I mentioned that also before. Same, if you look at it, if you look closely at your hand, you see it also. But there are areas here where you see the same pattern as on your fingerprint. Yeah, a pattern like that can also be used for shape of the hand. Retina, I mentioned the back of the eye. So here you have an eye, and you have your lens, and you have your iris, and then light is falling into that. And then here's a blind spot. And then they take a circle of a specific diameter at the back of your eye, and they look at this area, so not the full circle, but just this round part. And they look at where you see blood vessels or not. So that color pattern of blood vessels are no blood vessels. Signature, everybody knows about signature. We can measure, obviously, what the signature looks like. But we can do better if we also measure some dynamic information, like how fast is somebody writing? Yeah, in what order are these lines put on the paper? Yeah, what is the speed of the pen? If we have a specific pen, we might also measure how much the pen is tilted. So is the pen straight up or is it tilted? Or what is the pressure? With how much pressure am I pressing the pen on the paper? Yeah, that will also give me extra information. Then the one that is the odd one out, as I said in the beginning, living person, yeah, single. So that biometrics is just meant to single out a single person, to identify or authenticate a single person. In soft biometrics, we are actually not identifying or recognizing a single person, but we are trying to extract some information about this person and then use that further on in the biometrics process. So, for example, suppose that I'm doing face recognition. From a facial picture, I can, with relatively good accuracy, determine if somebody is male or female. Not always. Some people have very androgynous faces where it's difficult to determine. From a picture, I can also often see an age group. I can't say this person is 20 years old or this person is 21 years old. I can't make that distinction. But I can distinguish between a teen and an elderly, a senior, and something in between. So if I know from a picture that it is a male over 40, Yeah, and I'm looking at this room. There are many people that I can exclude in my further process. So in soft biometrics, it's not so much used for identifying a single person, but to extract extra information that could be helpful in a further process. Last one that I want to say is voice. So in voice, when you look at voice recognition, there are two things that we have to distinguish. One is speech recognition. What is somebody saying? That's very interesting, but not for biometrics. The other thing is how who is saying it. So then we're talking about speaker recognition or voice recognition. Can be based on fix or free text. Yeah, either I say the my password all of the time, open sesame, or I can just speak and some general features of my voice are extracted. Obviously, if I have a fixed text, I know what to look for and it's much easier. I get much better performance. So that was a long list of examples. Took me more time than I expected, so I'll quickly continue. What makes all of these, yeah? Yeah, that could be indeed responding to stimuli could be some something. Depending on the stimuli, I would opt for such a system or not. Yeah, if that is dipping me into a bath of ice, I'm not sure if that would be a good. So, how high do you scream when I hit you or something like that? That's a stimuli, and there is a response, but not all of that. But it could be. I don't know. Yeah. Yeah, I not included here. Brain waves, EEG or ECG are good biometrics also, but are not included in this. There are many more, so I will stop here though. The seven properties that any biometric modality should have are these: universality, distinctiveness, etc., etc. So let me explain them quickly. Universality: each person should possess this one. So that's coming back to your particular moles and whatever, yeah. Not everybody has that, so you can use it as a soft biometric. There is a mole in this position, so that excludes people who don't have moles, or tattoos or whatever. Yeah, but it doesn't single out a single person. Yeah. Every person should have it. At least most persons should have it. I mean, there are people who don't have arms or hands. Still, we use fingerprints. Yeah. So most people or the people relevant to a particular system should possess that characteristics. Distinctiveness. It should be different for different people. If my fingerprint and your fingerprint is the same, then we lost. Yeah. So my fingerprint should be unique. And it should be permanent. If my fingerprint today and my fingerprint tomorrow are different, so how is that system going to recognize me then? And obviously, not, it says, sufficient invariant over a period of time. 20 years ago, I looked slightly different. 30 years ago, I even had hair, right? Sure, my face will change over time, but it is a slow change. Obviously, if I have an accident today, that influences my face, yeah, then I have a problem. But those are exceptions, of course.
What do you mean by a period of times? Like 10 years?
Yeah, something like that, maybe even a year. If I know that my face will change, well, 5 years from now, my face looks so much different than it is now, okay, then within that period of 5 years, I have to enroll again. And what that means, I will say in a minute. Yeah, but if that period of time is just a week, yeah, then the system becomes unpractical. Yeah, so if my characteristics are in a database, I should be able to use those characteristics for a long enough period of time to not be bothered too often to put new characteristics in there.
When we have an injury on the finger or something, does it change
No. If you cut your finger, yeah, that's a nice experiment. Try it. If you cut your finger, it will grow back exactly the same. Fingerprints are very fingerprints are actually formed in the womb, and I'll tell you in a couple of slides how that process is done, or not how that process is done, but something about that. You actually have two layers of fingerprints. You have the inner and the outer fingerprint. And the outer fingerprint is what we see. The inner fingerprint is a few millimeters below that. Yeah. If I take some sandpaper and I start rubbing it, at some point my fingerprint will be gone. Yeah, my outer fingerprint will be gone. But based on my inner fingerprint, it will regrow in the exact same way. Obviously, if I cut too deep, I get a scar. Sure, there are changes. Yeah, but with normal wear and tear of a fingerprint, it will grow back in the same way. Okay, that was permanence. Collectability. Should be easy to collect electronically and to quantify. So there is where odor is getting into trouble. This machine should be able to process my data. So it should be able to capture it somehow. Should be accurate, should work fast, there should not be too many errors, and about errors we'll talk in a minute too. Acceptability. Are you willing, if I have this sensor that will send light into your eye and reflect from your retina, right? Are you willing to use such a sensor? Could be questionable, right? Will it hurt my eye? Yeah. Will I be able to see 10 years from now if I use that on a daily basis? Yeah. So acceptability. Same with, for example, fingerprints. Fingerprint research is quite old, but the commercial application is not that old. Why was that? 20, 30 years ago, they were taking fingerprints. Well, they is then the police. And they were taking fingerprints from criminals. And there were these 10 card inked fingerprints. Yeah. So taking a fingerprint of a person meant that they were a criminal. So I'm not going to use fingerprints. You're not going to get my fingerprint. I'm not a criminal. Yeah. So people didn't accept it. Nowadays, it's very much accepted. Everybody uses it on their iPhone, or many people use it on their iPhone or other phones. And circumvention is very, very important. If it's very easy for me to just come up with a fake fingerprint or a fake image, I'll put on a mask and the system will accept me, yeah, then that's not a good thing. Yeah, then anybody can be me again. Having that said, if I can easily make a LaTeX fingerprint that will react to my fingerprint scanner, that doesn't mean that fingerprint is not a good biometrics. That could also mean that this scanner is bad, this sensor. Yeah, and obviously this sensor is in my phone, and my phone is not that expensive, so the sensor can't be very expensive. Yeah, so can't be very good either. There are fingerprint scanners that will, with any kind of fake fingerprint that you will come up with, they resist it. Yeah, this one won't. Obviously. Same for the iPhone. This is not an iPhone. Yeah, so these are some properties that you have to check. Generally, in research that we do, we focus on distinctiveness and permanence. And we talk about the algorithm for comparison. So biometric system has two modules. One is the enrollment module. Yeah, you use it once in that period of time that your biometric modality stays stable, at least. And you go to your system administrator and say, here's my fingerprint. You put it on a scanner. He checks if it's good quality. If it's good quality, they process it. They extract the minutiae, extract features from it, and they store that in a database together with my identity. Right? Then the other module is, okay, I just went to the IT department. I gave my fingerprint, and they know me now. And then I go to the back to my office, and there is my computer, and I present my fingerprint again. Right? That is a thing that I will do often. Every time that I have to open my computer, I will present my fingerprint. So you use it multiple times. And then what happens is, again, a picture of my fingerprint is taken, the minutiae are extracted, and then these minutiae are compared to what is stored in the database based on my claimed identity, because the username was my claimed identity, right? Yeah, so the system takes the minutiae that they just extracted there, they send that to the database, and check it with and look up what features Patrick Boos has, and then they make a comparison. That's a lot of assumptions. Now I assume that they sent it over, or the comparison could be done on my computer, but we'll not go into that. Alternatively, the second module could be identification. So again, I could use that multiple times, but I'm not checking it against just the fingerprints of me, but against the full database. Here we have it. This is again from the ISO document. We have it also. We have a sensor, and I come with my fingerprint. So the biometric characteristics, which is my fingerprint, are put on the sensor. They capture the biometric sample. So once it is in electronic form, I call it biometric sample. There's some quality checking, or could be. Features are extracted and either stored in the database during enrollment or during authentication. I look in the database, given my identity, my claimed identity, and I do a comparison here. Then back to why my fingerprint is my fingerprint and why it is formed in the womb already. There are three origins of biometric characteristics: epigenetic, randotypical, and conditioned. So epigenetic means that we are the child of our two parents. So some of the characteristics of both our father and mother are given to us through the genes. The fact that I have brown eyes is because my mother had brown eyes and my father had blue grayish eyes, and so based on that there was a particular chance that I would get the brown eyes from my mother. Randotypical means that when a fetus is growing, a number of those processes, a number of the splitting of the cells is purely at random. Yeah, so the fact that my fingerprint looks like my fingerprint is pure based on a pure random process. That ensures that within this class there's nobody with this fingerprint. If I look at all 7 billion persons, yeah, there might be somebody who is very close. So it's never proven that all fingerprints are different, but a random process might generate twice the same output, right? Condition this, yeah, on when we, sorry, yeah? Oh, that's a very interesting question. Do twins have more similar fingerprints than... I don't know. That's very interesting. Don't mind if I write that down. And as far as I know, I will look up if it has been investigated, but I don't think so. Based on what is written here, I would say, no, it's a random process, but it's a random process going on at the same time in the same womb and... But still, there are two fetuses, feti, whatever. Anyway, the last one is conditioned. So we learn stuff from the moment that we got born. We learn how to talk, we learn how to walk, and things, and so that is behavior. But behavior can change. Obviously, I can learn myself new behavior. As one example, but that's difficult, by the way. It's not something trivial. By the way, when I walk or when I'm standing, my feet are standing a bit outward. Right? I have a friend who is an ice skater. Well, he was an ice skater. He's not doing it a lot nowadays. And with ice skating, he noticed it's better to have your feet parallel. Okay. So if I want to be a better ice skater, I better walk like this. So really like this instead, like more like Charlie Chaplin. Yeah. So he learned himself to have his feet parallel while walking. And that was not a process that he could do overnight. No, that took him several months, if not years. Every time that he was walking, he was in his mind conscious that his feet should be parallel. And if he wasn't thinking about it, at some point they would drift again to this more V-shape. And then, okay, now I have to parallel. Every time he corrected himself, and then after a long time of training, he learned to walk parallel. So that's a lengthy, it can be learned, it can be trained and changed, but it's a lengthy process. It's not something that you easily do. Okay. Let me see where we are and what we should cover. There we are. Okay, let me cover fingerprints before we have a break. This is a fingerprint, as you can see. So we have the dark and the light lines. So the ridges and the white lines are the valleys. And then when we look at a fingerprint, we can look at where a ridge is ending. So here, this particular ridge, this black one, stops here, doesn't continue. So that's called a ridge ending. There is another one here, and there are many more here on this picture. Ridge bifurcation is where a ridge is actually splitting in two. And so these are the features that I'm going to extract from a fingerprint. Those are called minutiae. And so here in green, I have my fingerprint that was extracted during enrollment. So this one is in the database, or not the fingerprint, but minutiae extracted from the fingerprint. We'll start here. And then this one is captured when I went back to my computer to authenticate myself. And you see differences between the two, right? I hope. Is it the same? Do you think it's the same finger, by the way? I could be fooling you and could give a completely different finger. It's the same, but don't worry. But this one is bigger because I had more of my finger on the scanner. It's a bit lighter. So here maybe my hand was slightly more moist or I pressed a bit harder or something like that. Or here it was dry. A finger deforms based on how hard you press. And so that will give a different picture. So the picture during enrollment and during authentication is never, never, never the same. Always different. So every time that I measure my fingerprint, it will be different. Even if I do it twice behind each other, it will be different. I might turn it a bit, I might I have deformations, yeah?
But can it fail you in authentication?
Yeah, it can. Yeah, we'll talk about errors after the break, but it can fail me. So now I zoomed in on more or less a common part, and I have some global features. I will not talk about that, but there is a delta here, and there is a loop here. And I can identify them in both pictures, and I have this dotted line in between, and that is that I can use once I give my fingerprint like this, and the other time a bit twisted, and I can compensate for that using these two things. And then I find the number of minutiae in my template, in my database during enrollment and during the authentication step also. And then I have to see if these dots more or less match with this set of dots. That's what I want to do. Right? That will tell me something if it's the same person. Well, if the fingerprint is in the background, it's difficult to see, so we remove that. And so I have it during enrollment, and I have my minutiae during the authentication. This is called a reference, and this is called the probe feature set. And then I'm going to match those. So, okay, let's put them on top of each other. And then you see that many of these minutiae are almost in the same place. There also. But some minutiae were detected during enrollment, which were not detected during the authentication phase, and the other way around. Based on this, we can have a fairly good decision that this was from the same person. Yeah? If I would take two different fingerprints, there would be absolutely no relation between the green and the blue dots. Maybe one, maybe two would by accident be on the same place, but the others wouldn't. Okay, so that's where we'll stop now. After the break, I'm going to talk indeed, can biometrics fail me? Could be the green dots in completely different, even if it's the same fingerprint, the green and the blue dots. Yeah, we'll talk about that after the break. Let's have a 10-minute break and then we'll continue. Yeah? Sure. Yeah, I know they're not identical, but are they alike? So is your fingerprint and my fingerprint more different than my fingerprint and my evil brother's fingerprint? Yeah? So that's the question. So I'm not sure if...
It says, but not to the minute details.
Okay. Okay, good. Thanks. Okay. Then I'll see you in 10 minutes. Okay, shall we continue? Okay, so now you know a bit about fingerprints and a bit about how biometrics works. So we have a reference that we compare to a probe feature set, and then based on that comparison we'll get access or not. When we look at a password system, a password is correct or it's wrong. There's not a single system that says, oh, I see that he made a small typo, I'll let him in. Yeah, it's correct or it's wrong. Nothing in between, very binary. A token, exactly the same. It's a genuine token or it's a false token. There's no midway. If I go to the ATM and I'll insert my Ansattekort, there's no system that says, ah, the wrong card, but I see the picture and it's him. Yeah? It's not accepted. It's wrong or it's right. Zero or one. In biometrics, we already saw that the biometric sample, which is captured from the sensor, is never exactly the same. There are small differences, there are larger differences also, but it's never exactly the same. So in biometrics, the best we can do is say, it is most likely this person, or it's most likely not that person. Yeah? So we'll never have 100% certainty with biometrics. It's always on a grayscale. So how can we express that? So if it's not 100% yes or 100% no, we can calculate some score. Because at the end we have to make a yes-no decision. We have to make a binary decision, right? So what we can do is have some comparison score. We have the reference Q and we have the probe R, and we are going to compare them. And somehow I express that comparison into a number. And then based on that number, I'm going to make this yes-no decision. Yeah, but that number will never be 0%, will never be 100%. That will be somewhere in between. There are actually two flavors. One is that we calculate what is called a similarity score. How similar are these two sets of features? And obviously, the more similar, the better. So the higher the similarity score, the better. On the other hand, we have the dissimilarity score or the distance score. Yeah, and if two things are very similar, then they are very much alike. So the distance between them is small. Yeah, so there where we say for a similarity score, the higher the better. For a dissimilarity score or for a distance score, we say the lower the better. Yeah, if I would have two identical elements, so if the probe and the reference would be exactly the same, then the distance is zero. They have infinite similarity, very high, and they have distance zero, very low. Yeah? And the higher the distance, the more apart these two are. You can easily go from one to the other with simple transformations, but I don't care about that too much. Generally speaking, in biological biometrics, you see that they often use a similarity score. In behavioral biometrics, you'll often see a dissimilarity score or a distance metric. There are a number of tests that we can do, from technology testing all the way to operational testing. Technology testing is that's what we do here at a research facility. Yeah. How do I compare? How do I calculate the similarity between these two sets of minutiae that we saw before? Yeah. And how well? Yeah. Now we did it for two fingerprints, but what if we have a large set of fingerprints? Yeah. What if I have two biometric samples from the same finger and from different fingers? How will my similarity score react to those? That's called technology testing. Scenario testing is, okay, at some point we found a good way of comparing, and then we'll set up a system here again internally where we ask a number of people to start using it and see how it will test, how it will perform in such a small environment. And if that goes well, then we can do actually an operational testing. Yeah, how would this system work if I would set it up at Gardermoen? Yeah, how? Because then the circumstances are much less controlled than in scenario testing. Yeah, so then we get much, we can learn much more from that. Here is a pipeline of what the process is. In this case, it's for, because there is a biometric reference, it's for enrollment. The enrollment ends with a biometric reference. So we have the biometric characteristics, which is my fingerprint, which we capture on a sensor, and then I get the biometric sample. From the sample, I do feature extraction, so find the minutia and find the core points, which is then called a template. And then that template can either be stored for enrollment, or it can be used for authentication. If this was the pipeline for authentication, then I would use it at that point in time, of course. But a lot of things can go wrong. So here we have the first part, the capturing part of my biometric characteristics, and for some reason, no image was generated. Yeah, maybe I had some dirt on my finger so that it couldn't register. Maybe I just took away my fingerprint at the moment that I wanted to capture it. So there's no image generated. Yeah, that is what is called a failure to capture. I couldn't capture the fingerprint. I couldn't get from the biometric characteristic to the biometric sample. So that's one of the errors that can occur. Another error is, okay, suppose that I was able to capture this biometric sample, so this image of my fingerprint. Then I have to look if I can find minutia in there. But that can also go wrong. Think about a face recognition system. Yeah, and you're taking a picture of my face, but I'm standing in front of a window, and there is it's a sunny day, and there is a lot of window coming in, so my face is just a black blob. So yes, I captured the image of your face, I have my biometric sample, but I can't find any features on that, so I can't extract them. Yeah, or I just was shaking my head, or I was looking down, I can't extract the features from this. Yeah, so that is called a failure to extract. I have the biometric sample, but I can't get features from that. Then there is something which is called failure to enroll. For this person, I never get through this process that I can store the biometric features in the template then in a database, the reference template in a database. And it just never happens. For example, I work in construction. Yeah, and in construction, it's hard work, hard labor. I'm working with my hands, and my fingerprints, they just wear off. Yeah, so every time that I go, I can capture a picture, but it's very vague, very light. I can't extract anything from it. Maybe I have a skin disease. That doesn't allow that. And then we get, even though I get through this process a number of times, it always stops here. Yeah, I can't get all the way up till here. Yeah, that's what we call a failure to enroll. I will not go into these slides too much, but we can, according to the ISO harmonized biometric vocabulary, we can have some calculations. Yeah, so the failure to capture is the failure to where the number of attempts that is captured and the number of attempts with a very low quality of the sample divided by the total number of captures. Failure to extract, the same. I just count how often I can't extract my template and how much I tried it in total, and so I divide them and I get the failure to extract. Failure to enroll in a similar way. I'm going to the interesting one. This is the interesting one. When we're doing biometric research, as I was saying, we are looking at, okay, I have this big database of fingerprints, and I have them. I have the minutiae extracted, so I have these templates already. Some can play the role of reference. Some can play the role of probe, and then I'm doing testing on that, right? Here, it is possible to get a so-called false match rate. So what's a false match rate? It says match. So apparently, the system made a decision that the reference and the probe are from the same person, from the same finger. But it's a false match. Actually, it shouldn't have decided that. Yeah, so it can happen that somebody else's fingerprint will be accepted as mine. Yeah, and how often does it happen? That's called the false match rate. So the proportion of the completed biometric non-mated comparison trials that result in a false match according to the harmonized biometric vocabulary. Alternatively, that's what your question was based upon before the break, I guess, I can have a false non-match rate. It's a non-match. So the system said, no, problem reference are from different persons, but it's a false non-match. So actually they were from the same person, except that the system made a wrong decision. Yeah, and how often does that happen? Yeah, so it happens that maybe because I just cut it and still the wound is healing or something like that, or maybe I pressed too hard, or maybe it was a very wet fingerprint or whatever. There are reasons that it can go wrong. Yeah. Yeah. So in that picture you saw that you get differences.
Yeah.
And you will get differences.
And it's going to be grindier?
No. Because that's the way that you present your biometric characteristic, your real fingerprint. Yeah, that is captured, then it's called a biometric sample. So then I have different biometric samples, although the biometric characteristic is the same, right? But I have different biometric samples from that. And both can be used to extract features because the quality of these was sufficient. I can extract features from them, and that will be two different sets of features. Yeah?
And one more question. You said that it's never 100% matched.
Yeah?
Because there's a percentage that is probably pre-decided.
Yeah?
For example, if the system considers you authenticated with a 60% match, I think you have to set the value.
Mm-hmm. How much matching will result in a yes or no answer? That we'll get to in a minute. Yeah. But no matter how I set it, I will never get a system which is perfect in the sense that no false fingerprint will be accepted and all the genuine fingerprints will be accepted. Yeah. The other way around. Anyway, there will be mistakes. However, I'll set this what is called a threshold in biometrics. Yeah. If you read literature on biometrics, you will often see that they use false accept rate and false reject rate, which sounds similar. False accept rate is somebody is accepted. But it was a false accept, so they should not have been accepted, and false reject similar. So false accept rate is apparently related to the false match rate, and false reject rate is related to the false non-match rate. Except that, did I put it here? Yeah. False match and false non-match rate are related to the comparison algorithm. So these are algorithmic errors. False accept and false reject rate are errors of the full system, the full biometric system, from including all these, from the presenting my biometric characteristic to the sensor all the way to the decision point, and not just that comparison component of that. And they are related via the failure to acquire. We'll not go deeper into that now. What is interesting is, you mentioned that there is a particular threshold that determines if somebody is accept or if a biometric probe is accepted or not. I can change that. Yeah, and changing that threshold will have an influence on the false match rate and the false non-match rate. And in fact, it will be such that if I change it in such a way that the false match rate will go down, that will make the false non-match rate go up, and the other way around. Yeah, and I can play with that, and at some point that will be the same. False match and false non-match rate will be the same for a particular threshold. I don't know what it is, but there is a threshold for which it is the same. That particular value of false match and false non-match rate, when they are the same, is called the equal error rate. And very often, systems are described, the performance of a system is described in equal error rate. But that is just one way that I can use the system. If I want a very secure system, I make sure that the false match rate is very low, and the false non-match rate might be a bit higher. So that means that me as a genuine person, sometimes I'm rejected by the system and I just have to try again. Yeah. Or if it's an open system where I should be user-friendly, I should make the false non-match rate low because I don't want to bother people. Well, that means that the false match rate is a bit higher and somebody might misuse the system. Yeah. Yeah. So that could happen. If you could send me a link to that research, that would be great. But it's not just twins that could be, because their fingerprints are similar, that could be accepted as somebody else. It can be anybody. Yeah. I've been talking about the harmonized biometric vocabulary a couple of times, and why is that? Because actually, we could see a sentence like this in biometric research. A false non-match, which we talked about. So we talked about false non-match rate. That's a probability that a false non-match occurs, of course. A false non-match occurs if two match samples are matched and are found to not match. That's a lot of matching, right? Actually, what it should be something like this. A false non-match occurs if two samples from the same source, or two mated samples, is also called in the harmonized biometric vocabulary. Yeah, if two samples from the same source are compared, yeah, matching is matching and compared in English is the same, but because match has a different meaning in biometrics, we prefer the word compared. Are compared, so I'm looking if they are similar, and found to not match. Yeah, that is clear. That can be the same. Yeah, so that is why we stick very, very closely to this terminology. Here you see, actually, suppose that I have a large database. A large database of a number of references. For a, let's say, for 100 person, I have a reference. And from these 100 person, I have a lot of probes also. Yeah, and then I'm starting to compare the reference of a person to his own probes. I get what is called a genuine score. Yeah? And if I look at all the genuine scores that are generated in my system, they are distributed something like this. Yeah? This is actually a distance score. I see that now. Is it a distance score? If a distance score, then yeah. This is called a distance score in this case. So the smaller, the better. Yeah? So all these are from genuine comparison. The probe and the reference from the same person, and all of these values are relatively small, but some are a bit bigger. Then I'll take the reference from one person, and I compare it not to his own probes, but I compare it to probes from other persons. That's called an impostor score that I calculate there. And I can look at, if I do that for my whole database, I get a lot of impostor scores, and I can look at the distribution from that also, and I get some higher scores, but some of them are lower also. So if my threshold would be here at 20, yeah, that means that if it's below 20, I'll say, yeah, okay, you're accepted by the system. It's above 20, then you're not accepted by the system. So what happened? There are a number of genuine attempts where a person is trying to be honest, where they got a distance score which was more than 20, and so the system says, okay, you're rejected. So these are all the things that was happening here were false non-matches. So this is the false non-match rate. There is a typo there. Yeah. On the other hand, there were a number of impostor scores which were below the threshold. Yeah, and those get accepted, while they should not have been accepted. So this is the false match rate. Yeah. And if I change this threshold, well, then this yellow and green area will get smaller or larger. Yeah, and so my false match and false non-match rates will change. And if I go this way, then the green one will get smaller and the yellow one will get bigger. One will go up, the other will go down. Yeah. Let's look at how this is in person. So I have here five probes. Probe from person one, probe from person two, three, four, and five. And all these five different persons, also gave me a reference. Yeah. So the reference is in the database, the probe is what I'm testing against. And if I compare probe 1 to reference 3, I'll get a distance of 435, whatever that means. I don't know what it means. Yeah, but it is a distance, so the smaller the better. So a high value is apparently good, and a low value is for a probe 1 against reference 1. So that should actually match. So it's a low value, that's great also. So suppose that my threshold is 225. Will this person get accepted? It's below the threshold. So he will get accepted. So that's good. And this one? And this one? This one will be accepted too? And this one? Oh, this one is rejected. But this one will be accepted again. So out of my 5 genuine attempts, one of them is rejected. So we have 1 false non-match. Yeah? Actually, I've done the false matches in the slide first. How many false matches will be accepted?
3.
I don't see 3 of them. No, I don't see 4 either. 1. Which one? This one, right? This is below the threshold. This imposter, so person number 1 said, no, no, I'm person number 4. And his probe will actually be accepted. Yeah, so we got 1 out of 20. There are 20 values in here. 20 imposter values. Yeah, I'm not counting the ones on the diagonal. Yeah, 1 out of 20 is accepted, falsely accepted. So the false match rate is 1 out of 20. False non-match rate would be 1 out of 5. Right? Okay. So let's see if my threshold goes up 250. What will be the false match and the false non-match rate? Say again, false match rate is? How many imposter attempt, false match, right? It is a match, but shouldn't have been. So it's imposter. So it's anything except the ones in bold. How many are accepted, yeah?
3
out of 20 are accepted, exactly. Those 3?
Yeah,
they'll all be... How about the false non-match rate? It's not 1, it's 1 out of 5, right? There's 1 false match, so the false... Sorry, 1 false non-match, so the false non-match rate is 1 over 5, yeah? 20%. Yeah, and if my threshold goes up, apparently my false match rate goes up. And in this case, the false non-match rate didn't go down, but it certainly would not go up. If I go the other way, then you will see, I will just do this. Actually, there will be no false matches, because the lowest score here is 208. Yeah, but there will be 2 false non-matches. So this is a very secure system. No imposter will get in, but yeah, 2 people, 2 genuine persons have to give their fingerprint again. So if we have the threshold, and we increase it, then the false match rate will go up and the false non-match rate will go down, and the other way around. This, again, this is all for distance scores. Not for similarity scores, but for distance scores. Yeah. If it was for similarity scores, actually the whole thing would swap. Yeah, because they are the higher the better. How can we report the performance? We can use 2 kind of curves. One is called decision error trade-off curve, that curve, which plots false match rate against false non-match rate. So now all of a sudden the threshold is gone. But if I go back here, if I take a particular threshold here, I get a particular false non-match rate and a particular false match rate. And if I take another threshold, I get a different pair. Yeah, and if I look at all these pairs and I plot them, I'll get something like this. Yeah, so I plot the false match rate against the false non-match rate. In a receiver operating characteristics, it's actually the same graph, except that I flipped it. Yeah, I flipped it upside down. And so I'm plotting now the false match rate against not the false non-match rate, but 1 minus the false non-match rate, which is called the genuine match rate. So, in principle, these are the same. Now I have a linear scale on both these pictures, both these graphs. You can also use a logarithmic scale. That's often done. Then if I want to know, at some point I'm doing research, right? I'm testing particular methods for comparison, right? And I found a particular method, and that gives me this black graph. Then when I change, when I leave everything the same, except that I play with the threshold, that means actually I'm just looking at a different point of this curve, right? And I can get a better false match rate, but that at the cost of a worse false non-match rate, or the other way around. If I want to make a fundamental change, I have to change my comparison method. Okay, so I compare them first with method one, and I get some performance, I get some dead curve. And then I decide, okay, this I got that blue dead curve, and that's not good. I want a better performance, so I change my comparison technique, and I get another dead curve, the green one. Well, that's better. Why is it better? Because it's closer to the origin. The best dead curve would be like this. Yeah, again, if I start playing with the threshold and something like that, doesn't help me, I will just get another point on the green curve. But what if I change the method again? So we had comparison method 1, comparison method 2, now we'll take comparison method 3. Okay, I'll get the red curve. Even, again, improvement, because the equal error rate is getting down all the time. And the lower the equal error rate, the better. And then I change it again, and a fourth method, and I can draw again a dead curve. And then I see that, okay, between red and black, there is very little difference. Actually, you see them swap. Sometimes the black is better than the red, and sometimes the red is better than the black. So I can't really say that one is better than the other. In terms of equal error rate, people might say that red is slightly better than black, but that's statistically not a sound statement anyway. Yeah, so I can draw different curves based on different analysis techniques. Forget about this part. That doesn't matter. Yeah? And so once I found a method, a comparison method that gives me a good dead curve, so close to the origin as possible, and then that I can use in a scenario testing, and later on maybe in a practical testing. So far we talked about authentication, but how about identification in biometrics? We know how to do it. We have to compare one probe against all the references and then look at which one is closest, which has the highest similarity or maybe the lowest distance, whatever method you use. Yeah? And then obviously, if my fingerprint is matched against a database of fingerprints, so my probe fingerprint is matched against compared against a list of reference fingerprints, and actually your fingerprint comes out as the closest, yeah, that's a problem. Yeah, my fingerprint should be the closest. So we can make an error. So what is the system? Here's my biometric data, so my probe. Here is the whole database. All the references, and so we compare them. For each element in this database, I have a comparison, and then I look when do I find the. In this case, I'm looking at the maximum, so I'm looking at similarity scores. The higher similarity, the better. So I'm looking when do I find the highest similarity score, and that the index of that will tell me which this person is. If I know that this person is in this database, I can forget about this last part. Yeah? Then we're talking about a closed set identification. Any probe that I'm throwing into the system, that I'm matching against my references in the database, will be of somebody who has a reference in the database. And then I just see which one matches best. In an open set identification, this biometric data could come from somebody who has a reference in the database, or it could be from somebody totally unknown to the system. So what I do then at the end is also have a comparison. Okay, I have my best score here. But if that best score is low, again, similarity. So if that best score is very low, yeah, then it actually doesn't really match against any of those in the database. Yeah, and then I just say, okay, I don't accept this person at all. I reject him. Yeah, if I have a score that is high enough, the best score is high enough, okay, then I found my person. But obviously, I can make mistakes in this case. Again, it's biometrics. In this case, we draw what is called a CMC curve, a cumulative match characteristic curve. What is the probability that when I give my fingerprint to this identification system that the system says, yes, it's you? That's actually rank one. If it makes a mistake and it points to somebody else as being the best one, what is the probability then, or what is the chance that I would actually was at the second place? Yeah, if that particular person wasn't in the database, I would have come first. That's what is called rank two. Yeah, and rank two actually says what is the probability that it's either first or second. So that's actually a bit more than rank one. And rank three is what is the probability that my reference was among the top three. So that's always increasing. So what is my probability that my fingerprint was among the N first one, when there are N people in the database? Yeah, obviously it's there. Yeah, I could be on the last place. And so this probability is one. And then you get a curve like this. So the probability that I come in the first place is here something like, 67%. And the probability that I would be on first or second would be almost 75%, and then it increases, obviously. And again, I can test different comparisons methods, and I get different curves. And obviously, the higher this curve is, the better. Yeah, here I have a probability, with the red one, I have a probability of over 90% already that I am identified as the correct person, so rank one. Yeah. And then very quickly, rank two, three, four, rank five already, I'm at 100%. So I never end up at a place less than the fifth, lower than the fifth. Yeah, so this is a CMC curve for identification. Okay, we ended more or less on time. I didn't expect that. Any questions? No questions? That's good. This afternoon, I will give a presentation on a topic which is very near to my heart, which is on keystroke dynamics. I will tell you what we have done here and what can be done with that. I will go into some of the very interesting research that we'll go into later on. Jürgen and Emil have taken a biometrics course in the spring semester, last spring semester, and they had to do biometric research. Jürgen has done that on keystroke dynamics also, and he will tell something about that. And then Emil will actually go into fingerprint recognition, say something about the history and something about the comparisons. And actually what we'll do, a bit of interaction, we will ask you to look at particular fingerprints. Ask you to look at particular fingerprints. There, where is it? There. Yeah, and can you identify in this fingerprint the minutiae or a number of minutiae? Yeah, can you identify a rich bifurcation and a rich ending? Yeah, so you'll get a set of, you'll work together in small groups, you'll get a number of fingerprints and then work on that. Yeah? Any questions? Okay, if not, then I'll see you in A153 at 1:15.